welcome to episode 19 of FemWonk. I'm your host, Katie Davey, and today we're going to do a recap from Women Deliver 2019. I just wanted to highlight what exactly Women Deliver is, so by quoting their website and their about section, Women Deliver is a leading global advocate that champions gender equality and the health and rights of girls and women. Our advocacy drives investment, political, and financial in the lives of girls and women worldwide. We harness evidence and unite diverse voices to spark commitment to gender equality. And we get results. Anchored in sexual and reproductive health, we advocate for the rights of girls and women across every aspect of their lives. We know that investing in girls and women will deliver progress for all. Women Deliver hosts a global conference, which is what we're going to recap now. The Women Deliver 2019 conference took place from June 3rd to June 6th in Vancouver. It was the world's largest conference on gender equality and the health, rights, and well-being of girls and women in the 21st century, and it plans to serve as a catalyst for advocates working to achieve a more gender-equal world. If you're interested in the content, much of it can actually be found online, so please feel free to check that out if you are interested. I attended Women Deliver as a Women Deliver Mobilization Canada bursary recipient. The Mobilization Canada movement brought together around 50 advocates from across Canada to participate in Women Deliver. You'll hear from some of the East Coast recipients later in this episode. FemWonk is also one of the many mobilizers from across the country working to continue the momentum of Women Deliver, and you can check out the other mobilizers, including events happening at wedeliver2019.org. So, we weren't actually sure how to cover this conference in a meaningful way, particularly through a 25-minute podcast. So we're taking this opportunity to experiment a little bit. I decided I would just take out my iPhone and record my thoughts periodically throughout the conference. So this does mean that the audio quality is often a bit choppy and lots of background noise. We're going to try to use our editing tools to cut that down, but I really thought this was a way to get authentic in the moment feelings. So I'm going to kick off this episode with about 20 minutes of snippets that are just me kind of talking about the sessions that I attended and some of the takeaways I got and some of the things I'm more interested in talking about. In the spirit of mobilization, I also asked three other East Coasters to give me their thoughts on a few questions. You'll hear them towards the end of this episode. Okay, so I'm now going to insert some of our thoughts from the conference.
It's June 3rd, and I'm sitting at the Vancouver Convention Center on technically the first day of the Women Deliver Conference. The open plenary will be happening at 4:30. There have been tons of events throughout the whole week already leading up to the conference itself. So last night, June 2nd, I attended a panel on the future of work and what that means for women and girls, and I thought that was really interesting. There were some really phenomenal people on the panels. It was hosted by UN Women, and the executive director for UN Women was there and on the panel. There were also researchers and folks from the business sector. I thought that that was a good cross-sectoral representation and insight. What I found to be so interesting about this discussion was a real focus on how the future of work will have to be multi-pronged, and also about how women and girls actually will experience the changes in the future of work differently. We know that women traditionally take on not only unpaid caregiving work, but also a lot of jobs in the current economy that are caregiving-based. We also know there's a lack of representation of women in many tech-based sectors and STEM fields. I thought it was really interesting, though, that point came up and there was a bit of a debate among the panelists about, encouraging women, or really, I guess, more aptly in this case, girls to go into the STEM fields, which is obviously a very kind of hot topic, and rightly so. Women and girls are dramatically underrepresented in the science, technology, engineering and math field, but it was really the disagreement, I guess, was that as we move forward with some of these really complex challenges, whether it's machine learning or AI, automation, etc. One, yes, we need women that are at the table and at the programming table, but some of the challenges will actually be around supporting what this looks like in our modern society, from regulations and governance, critical thinking, judgment, and challenging the biases that may arise through these developments. So, you know, as a liberal arts grad myself, that was very nice to hear. But I think that that's like obviously a very interesting point in the wider conversation about the future of work, and why, you know, if we just drive girls into the STEM fields, yes, that's important and we need more parity in this field, but that is not necessarily going to solve the problems of equality in the tech space as we move forward. So really, really thought that was an interesting takeaway from that. And I just was happy to be involved in that conversation. I think it's important to be having. And I think for me, and this came up a little bit, but for me, one of the biggest pieces that I think about when I think about the future of work is how our social safety nets and how our governments are going to react to what that looks like. You know, as the gig economy rises, folks are not necessarily going to have full access to healthcare benefits. They're not going to have the same access to unemployment insurance, for example. They're not going to have the same access to pension contributions as our parents and their parents' generations had, based on the fact that they worked with, you know, the same company for 30 years, in a way that is just not going to be the case moving forward and isn't the case now. So for me, it's really like, I'm really interested in learning more about what that pivot in our social safety nets look like. Yeah, I got a lot of value out of that session, and it was a great way to kick off my participation in Deliver. So hugely grateful to be attending the mobilization bursary recipients, and we actually kicked the day off this morning, early 8 a.m. meeting, to meet everybody and discuss a little bit more about what that looks like. And to be honest, I was actually very overwhelmed by emotions. The conversation kept coming up about the fact that, you know, we are so privileged to physically be in this space and to have that opportunity, and also that for a lot of folks, it was a journey to get here, both in actual miles, kilometers, sorry, the country is very large, but in other types of barriers, whether it be accessibility barriers or other. And I think I was just very overwhelmed by both, I guess, compassion and empathy for everybody in the room, and more broadly for everybody that will actually attend physically the event, and for those that are unable to attend. I thought it was just very powerful to remember the privilege that we have here, and also to empathize with folks, and recognize that everybody has their own journey to getting to this physical space, and to sharing, and to share compassion, and understanding when we engage with each other. I went to a session put on by the Federation of Canadian Municipalities, talking about getting more women involved in political leadership at the municipal level and more broadly. And I thought that was actually a very interesting session, because I think when we talk about, particularly in Canada, when we talk about women's participation politically, you know, folks always cite how many women we have in our Canadian Parliament, which is obviously far too low, but the conversation doesn't happen as much at the local municipal levels, which I think it should, because, you know, those folks are obviously the closest to their communities and create a bit of a pipeline for other leadership roles and positions. Something I didn't know was that in Canada, only 18% of our municipal mayors are women. Very low statistic, obviously. And again, one I think that we should continue to talk about and raise and to change. I also really appreciated that they shared the perspective of two international mayors, one from Ukraine and another from Latin America. They shared their perspectives as both being mayors that are women, and also what their communities look like and what the participation, what the gender participation is, but further what the services that exist in their communities look like to support both women and children. And I thought that was a really powerful piece to add to the conversation. And actually, I learned something that I didn't know. I actually had no idea that the Federation of Canadian Municipalities kind of supported the work of international municipal governance. I think, you know, interesting and a great role for them to play and to support, but I was happy to learn that they both participate and support that work, but also are able to get shared learnings from that work that happens across the globe. So that was an interesting perspective, and it was nice to get more of a global perspective there. But again, as we lead into the federal election in Canada, it is critically important to support women candidates at every level to achieve more of a gender parity in our parliament. So that is my call to action here. Back again for an update on what I've been spending my time doing at Women Deliver. One of the sessions I went to was called The Power of Evidence for Driving Progress and Change. I thought this was a really interesting discussion overall. It very much had a focus of data and why data is so important in decision-making overall, but the kind of the topic of driving progress and change. The one thing that really stuck with me was the discussion around vital statistics. So, sounds super fun, right? But vital statistics essentially are like, you know, when you're born and you register your birth, when you get married and you register that you are married, when you pass away and you register that you have passed away. Like vital statistics are basically just all of those kind of big life things that happen to you that is collected by the government, by and large. This, as a Canadian, is not something I ever really questioned at all. In the work I've done over the last few years, the only time this conversation would come up was actually around designated sexes on vital statistic documents. So again, like birth certificates, driver's license, passports, etc. And the removal of just the gender binary with the ability to add the X. But as far as actual, like, collection of vital statistics, it was just not something I really thought much about at all. But one of the panelists mentioned that in 100 countries around the world, the vital statistics collections and mechanisms are not clear or don't exist. And she highlighted some really key challenges, particularly for women and girls that come from those not being collected. So one of the things that the panelist said was that there are a number of child brides, girls who are brides, who have never been registered before. So picture, you know, they're born and there's no record of their birth. Maybe they don't actually go to school, so there's no record of them attending school. And then they're, you know, 14 or 12 or whatever, and they're forced into marriage, but there's no record of them existing. So think about, one, how difficult it is to actually see the statistics around how many child marriages there are, but also, like, what, in those cases, like this person, there's no record of this person, so what types of interventions can be provided? The other thing that I thought was very interesting, the person mentioned in a number of countries, particularly those that have significantly more reliance on religious ceremonies for marriage rather than kind of the state-certified ones, don't actually register their marriage at the state level, but are married again through a religious ceremony. Well, what happens is because, again, the state has no record of this marriage, a husband passes away or something happens, and the wife has no inheritance rights because their marriage was never recognized. So that's another example of key vital statistics and their collection and how they can support or hinder women, and particularly women in
and vulnerable situations. So I think that those are really key examples to me that I, again, would not have thought of, because in Canada, our vital statistics collection, by and large, not in, in all cases, is so on point that it's not really something we think about. I attended the plenary called The Power of Now, taking stock of where we stand and what opportunities and challenges lie ahead. This kicked off the conference, and there was quite a focus on the Sustainable Development Goals, and obviously particularly the ones pertaining to gender equality. I thought this was particularly interesting, and the executive director of UN Women mentioned how overall we are not anywhere near where we need to be to meet the Sustainable Development Goals in 2030. And she also mentioned that there are many countries, developed countries, like for example Canada, who are not on track to meet the Sustainable Development Goals. And she also called out developed countries like Canada on gender in parliament, because basically, like, there is, and her rationale is basically, there is literally no reason why a country like Canada does not have equal representation in its elected officials, and I, of course, tend to believe that. So I thought that that was an interesting lens and an interesting discussion to kick off the day with. I honestly am not as up to date on the Sustainable Development Goals or SDGs as I could be. This session was also kicked off by an announcement from Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announcing that the Government of Canada will raise its funding to reach $1.4 billion annually starting in 2023 to support women and girls' health around the world. This is a 10-year commitment and a historic investment to support sexual and reproductive health rights and maternal, newborn, and child care. And $700 million of this will be invested directly to support sexual and reproductive health rights as of 2023. This was something that was advocated on behalf of by many organizations across the world, actually, particularly in the wake of Donald Trump instating the global gag rule, meaning that they will not fund any international organizations that have any sort of sexual health mandate, including and particularly of reproductive health care, which honestly is appalling. I think we all know that that's appalling, but after being at Women Deliver and really like digging in and hearing the stories of folks around the world, I'm reminded of why it's so appalling. As my mother said to me the other day, which honestly shocked me, it's 2019, why are we still having this conversation? Women should be able to choose what they do, and it is none of my business. I think that's a great quote, and that is how I feel deeply about this issue. So I'm wildly supportive of this investment, and I'm happy Canada's leading the way on championing gender equality abroad. I went to a session called Money Talks, What Works in Budget Accountability. I think overall, one of the takeaways I had from this session, but many sessions over the last few weeks, is that we have not, one, as civil society, developed a meaningful way to hold governments accountable on their announcements and their investments, but also, again, governments are just not held accountable or being held accountable to their announcements, investments, etc. So I think that was a really interesting and big takeaway. I think one of the pieces around budget accountability, or there are a couple, I think, pieces that we can lean into. One is participatory budgeting, which basically, there are a couple of frameworks for it, but by and large it is a portion of government budget being brought to the people for them to vote on how to spend it. This seems to be a little bit more palatable, or rising in popularity, I guess maybe it's a better way of putting it, in municipal and local jurisdictions, but I think that there's no reason why this isn't something that could be implemented, even if you start with a small pocket of money, to get folks like understanding it, understanding and engaging in the process and grow further. The other thing is, of course, the gender budgeting, which the federal government in Canada has adopted now for the last two budgets. I think that the gender budgeting is really important for a whole bunch of reasons, and I think that the government of Canada actually presents it in a way that I actually found to be very useful and easy to read. They basically provide a gender chapter to their budget now that outlines each new investment and what impacts it will have on a diverse population. So they don't just focus on gender, they focus on, you know, if a particular decision would have more of an impact on young people or on older folks, or on folks in rural or urban. They basically take an intersectional approach to addressing how the budget is going to impact folks. So I think that was deemed to be an example of one of the ways that we could accelerate budget accountability and just more broadly accountability for governments. I went to a session that I found to be really interesting called In the Wake of Me Too, What Does the Workplace Look Like Now? I think this is obviously a bit of a hot topic and one that folks happily talk about. I often see the stat saying something like 60% of men in leadership roles now say they are uncomfortable mentoring women, for example. I mean, I think the question is, were they ever mentoring women? I would say the stats suggest no, based on the amount of women in leadership positions. They began the session actually by saying, raise your hand if you've been directly or indirectly impacted by sexual violence and harassment in the workplace, and nearly every single hand in the room raised. They also had a very interestingly curated panel, and one of the folks on the panel, Wade Davis, who is actually a former NFL player, but now works in the space of inclusion and diversity and intersectionality. And he actually mentors and works with men on breaking down these barriers, these gender barriers and these gender biases in the workplace. One of the interesting things that he said right at the beginning was men don't know about women's internal lives and they don't attempt to know. He said the first question he asks men that he works with is, what were the last three books you read written by women about women? And he said oftentimes they literally just kind of stare blankly at him, which I thought was a very interesting perspective, because again, we as women consume a lot of content written by and about men because that is what is in the marketplace, whereas women-specific content for women is not necessarily in the marketplace at the same rate. You know, even think about going back to our episode about the Oscars. So seeking that content out, I think, is like very important. And I thought it was just like, I thought he provided such a clear example of some of the challenges that we sometimes overlook, and particularly overlook as women when, you know, our personal lived experience and context is not being a man. I went to a session called Keeping Girls in School and Learning Longer. This is a very powerful session for a few reasons. One, a stat that they kicked us off with, 12 million girls under 18 are married every year. That's around a girl every 2 seconds, and this is happening all across the world. The reality is, in a lot of contexts, girls already have a difficult time accessing school and education, and if they're pregnant and or after they have a child, they're significantly less likely to continue their education or return to their education. This panel was also powerful because they had both the First Lady of Sierra Leone and a Plan International youth advocate from Sierra Leone on the panel. The advocate thanked the First Lady a number of times for free education in Sierra Leone, but also called upon her to remove other barriers and to support removing other barriers for girls to go to school. Again, back to what I was just mentioning on
girls being pregnant in Sierra Leone, you are not allowed to go to school if you're pregnant. So that's a very interesting differential, and I think one that we don't necessarily think about. The plenary, the morning plenary of the final day, June 6th, it's called The Power of Movements, What Happens When Many Demand Change. This panel was so powerful. I honestly was sitting there, like, in tears nearly the entire time, just overwhelmed by the people in the room, by the experiences shared, and by really the collective experience shared in the room. So we had the creator of the Me Too movement, Tirana Burke, on the panel. We had Tina Chen on the panel, the founder of the Time's Up movement. We had folks from the abortion rights movement in Ireland, folks from climate change advocacy organizations, folks from the labor movement. It was really a diverse panel, and like I said, it was just incredibly emotional, to be honest, and powerful, to say the least. I went to a session called The Power of Community, G7 and G20 Advocates and Stakeholders. This was a very interesting session because it was really like a workshop, and folks dove into what the asks should be around G7 and G20 from a perspective of gender. I honestly learned a lot from this session. I'm not entirely fluent in the workings of the G7 and the G20. And so I enjoyed this session a lot. I learned a lot, and I thought that it was really important for the folks engaging. It's really important, the work that they're doing, so I enjoyed learning from that. I attended the Local Women Journalists Are Transforming Global Narratives, Are You Listening? Panel. This was really enjoyable. It was enjoyable to hear of the women journalists working on the ground in their communities and some of the challenges that they face, but also the benefits that they face being from their own community and working in that space, and how much their local context really matters and what value they think that that brings. So I thought this was a really interesting panel discussion, and I was happy to get to be involved.
Thanks for listening to my recap of a few key sessions that I attended. I now want to share with you the perspective of three other folks, as well as my perspective on the questions that I will be asking. First question, tell me who you are.
So I'm Ashley Hall. I'm a community outreach worker for Crossroads for Women. Crossroads for Women is a domestic violence shelter.
Okay, so hi, my name is Allison Thorne. I work for KISRUP International Trade Routes, and we are an international development consultancy based in Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Hi, my name is Rachel Richard, and I'm the public engagement officer at the New Brunswick Coalition for Pay Equity.
I'm Katie from FemWonk. You all know me. What has been the most impactful thing for you at Women Deliver?
So I think the most impactful thing in general was just how much diverse it was, how much diversity there was. The panels were full of people with so much experience and so different experience. You don't really get that opportunity in New Brunswick. It's hearing from the same people, usually the same time, and this was, you get to hear from all over the world's perspective.
Absolutely. Well, each and every day has been overwhelmingly impactful, overwhelmingly positive, so many new sources of information each and every day on, creating a gender equal world. I think one of the stories that resonated with me most was listening to the president of the World Bank. She said that, she had always gone through her career with kind of blinders on in terms of a gender perspective, always thinking that it should be the best person for the job, and it shouldn't be only based upon creating that gender parity. And she said that she went to a meeting in Vietnam, and she was the only woman at the table. And after the meeting, a Vietnamese lady came up to her and said, "I just want to say thank you so much for coming all this way, and for showing the men in my country that a woman can lead and a woman can be in these conversations." And I think that, that really resonated with me, because it shows that, being a Canadian, we've grown up in such a society, and we're so blessed that we live in a place that gender parity is something that is, you know, always at the forefront. And I think that if we can continue to be leaders in creating a gender equal world, I think that's using our power.
I think seeing so women in one space together, being so optimistic about the future and being so empowered to act, I think just bringing that energy back to New Brunswick, I think it's especially in view of the upcoming federal election, I think it's a great way to start our mobilization and continue on with educating not only New Brunswickers but Canadians as well. As you well know, we adopted federal pay equity legislation last year, and we hope that that will be one of the topics of discussion during the next federal election, and we hope to continue building that momentum. And we've had some really great discussions with decision makers across Canada and across the world, and hopefully I can bring that energy and that that information and that passion back to New Brunswick and see how we can move forward.
For me, hearing the lived experience of the folks from around the world experiencing the things that we often talk about refocused for me not only the Canadian context of moving forward on gender equality, but it has rooted me back down into the importance of lived experience and the power of sharing personal stories rather than just relying on statistics. The overall theme was power, and many folks were asked about how they plan to use their power. So how do you plan to use your power?
So one of like the common like themes or common things I noticed was like how important education is for everything. So the way I plan on using my power is by promoting and providing education on gender equality, on gender-based violence. I do have kind of the power to do that. I have the connections in the schools, around the community, and I'm really going to push to be more out there providing that education.
So a big part of my job and my interest is, you know, working with the Global South and international development, you know, that sort of perspective. So I think that a way that each and every day that I try to use my power, you know, as a Canadian, as somebody who has these rights of a gender equal society, I think using my power is enabling, you know, programming and enabling situations where we can boost up women all around the world. Because, you know, it's said time and time and again, how are we supposed to advance if half our population is being held back? So I think that, you know, using our power has to start on an individual level. It has to start each and every day knowing that we as individuals are capable and we as women are capable in anything that we set our minds to. And, you know, kind of advocating for that on an individual level, I think, I hope, I pray that that kind of stems to the global scale.
I think one thing that really impressed me during the conference is seeing so many different kinds of women together using their voices towards one issue or similar issues. And I think that's one of the things that I find is a bit lacking in New Brunswick. And I hope that to bring that sort of mobilization effort to New Brunswickers and having to mobilize a greater number of women and amplify those voices. So I think that's so important instead of us speaking for women. I think we all have to give over the microphone to those women, especially workers who are in predominantly female sectors, to ask them what they want and what they want us to do. And instead of us telling them, you know, possible solutions and what we could happen or things that we could work towards, I think it's time that we amplify those voices. And I think that's one of the paths to finding better solutions to benefit all New Brunswickers.
I plan to use my power by creating space for more diverse voices here through the FemLong platform, but also calling out spaces that have not attempted to create a more diverse space. So whether that's panels that don't have appropriate gender representation or create a diverse space of intersectionality, or again, announcements, initiatives, things like that, that very much have not considered a gender element or an intersectional element, I'll plan to use my power and my voice to support the creation of that diversity lens for folks and to support moving forward on more inclusive decision-making broadly. Thank you so much for tuning in. Let us know what you thought of this episode by leaving a review. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at FemWonk, and by subscribing to our podcast wherever you listen.